Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Waiting for a bus? Well, how about recharging your devices and accessing free Wi-Fi while you wait? That's what you can do at new bus benches just launched as part of LA Mayor Eric Garcetti's Great Streets Initiative. But are they making LA streets greater?
I think it's cool. If the bus is taking too long and my phone is out of power, then I'll use to connect it to charge it.
And could we be living on Mars in the future? One forward-thinking team is already designing Mars City. That's all coming up. Before that, though, is recycling rubbish? I'm at Santa Monica's recycling centre. It's in a large yard right near the art galleries of Bergamont Station. Trucks are lumbering in and out, carrying their loads of recyclables. It's quite smelly, especially in this heat wave, but it's also fascinating to look at. You can see mountains of trash and then stacks of bales of squashed cans, plastic bottles and paper ready to be shipped to companies that will turn those sorted materials into new stuff. The bales are the end product of a cycle that starts with a pile of mixed trash that goes along a conveyor belt where workers are pulling out various bits of refuse. Wes Thompson is recycle coordinator for the city of Santa Monica.
Everybody's picking out a different material. He's picking out cardboard. They're picking out bottles. You can hear the bottles. The thing left at the end is white paper that you see the mountain of.
Is the white paper the desirable piece of all of this?
Yep.
I also meet a man who's driven in from outside Santa Monica. He's sorting out and throwing cans into a chute. So why is he not simply putting his recyclables in his own trash can for the city to pick up?
Pacific Palisades, where I'm from. Yeah, they come every week, pick it up. But I've heard it goes to landfill.
Wes Thompson says this man's belief is a widely held suspicion. But his dedication reflects a deep commitment to recycling in the US. According to the EPA, in 2013, we generated about 254 million tons of trash, and we recycled and composted about 87 million tons. But it's an effort that New York Times science writer John Tierney thinks is a big old waste of time and money.
Recycling started with the idea that we're running out of materials and that we're running out of space to bury garbage in landfills. And both of those ideas have turned out to be wrong. And partly because of that, it's more expensive generally to recycle than it is to bury trash in landfills or to incinerate it. And therefore, it doesn't really make economic sense to do it. And for most materials, it does make sense to recycle paper and cardboard and metals. And there are some environmental benefits there. But for most other stuff, it just doesn't really make economic sense. It doesn't do much for the environment. The big environmental benefit comes from reducing the need to make a new plastic bottle or to make a new soda can. And we're spending a lot of time, you know, trying to reach higher and higher kind of arbitrary goals of recycling everything, which to me doesn't make sense. I've seen cities claim that this pays for itself, but whenever I have seen a good independent audit, it generally shows that recycling costs more than alternative methods of waste disposal. And really the biggest cost of all to me, it isn't just what the city is spending to recycle this stuff. It's all the time that that people are spending. I mean, I did some calculations in my first article. If you actually counted the labor that everyone, you know, by turning all of us into unpaid garbage sorters, if you actually counted that, it makes recycling horrendously expensive. And when I think of all the time that, you know, the children spend in school learning about garbage, I went to a third grade classroom where they spent the whole week of science class studying garbage, and they were made to feel just terribly guilty that they were destroying the earth. The earth was going to be overrun with garbage, and if they didn't, you know, recycle that yogurt container, poor Mother Earth was really going to suffer. And I just wanted to tell them, look, you know, that yogurt container, it came out of the earth. It was put to a good purpose, and we'll put it back in the earth and safely cover it and turn it into a park.
But if people took all this to heart and decided, phew, I don't have to spend my time being an unpaid garbage sorter, I'll just, you know, let everything go to the landfill as it used to, Do you think it's okay to just consume and waste and consume and waste? I mean, is there not some sort of social value to keeping a measure of what we're buying and throwing away?
Well, I'd say that there are a couple of things. I mean, for a lot of people, it is this ritual of atonement, basically, that I feel bad about all the stuff I buy. You know, someone nicely said that, you know, all of us like to pretend that we don't like stuff, that we're non-materialist, and that garbage is the lipstick on the collar of our love affair with stuff. So, you know, people feel that they're atoning for that by recycling. And in the sense that it makes people feel better, I suppose it's, you know, there's nothing wrong with religious rituals. I just wish it wasn't mandatory for everyone else, because I don't have that same guilt about it. And I also don't, and I can't fool myself that my recycling makes much difference at all either.
You're listening to John Tierney. He's the author of a recent commentary for the New York Times called The Reign of Recycling. That follows up on a 1996 article in which he made more or less the same argument. That broke the record for hate mail at the New York Times magazine. But is there something to the timing of this piece? Adam Minter is author of Junkyard Planet, and he grew up with a family who worked in the waste disposal industry.
When you talk about carbon offsets and when you talk about saving energy, you're actually talking about saving money. And that's why we recycle. You know, it's all very nice. I mean, you know, Tierney likes to bring up that people are only doing it for moral reasons. But in fact, people do recycling for money. And that's why it's a hugely profitable business. You know, over the last 10 years, most years, it's been the number one export by volume from the United States to China. Well, why would China import a bunch of old American bottles or old American scrap paper, old American automobiles? Well, they're importing it because it's a cheaper raw material to use than to go and set up a new copper mine, say, or clear cut a forest somewhere in western China. It's a money savings. When you save energy, and you do save energy when you use recycled materials, you're actually saving money. Tierney doesn't address that. The last time he wrote an article about the recycling business was in the mid-1990s, and that's an interesting time for the recycling business in the global commodities markets because they were very flat at that point. And right around 1996, 97, after Tierney wrote his article, commodities underwent what's called the commodity supercycle, and they underwent one of the great runs of market-based enthusiasm in history. If you were in recycling from the mid-1990s to about a year and a half ago, you would have to try really, really hard to lose money because the price of commodities was just so high. About a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, Chinese growth started slowing down. And when Chinese growth started slowing down, they didn't need as much steel, they didn't need as much aluminum, they didn't need as much plastic, and that hurt the recycling business. And all of these municipal recycling programs around the United States, which had done extremely well, they were returning money to municipalities, started suffering. So for municipalities, absolutely, the municipalities right now are losing money. And it's a matter of waiting out the markets. You know, Tierney and other critics of recycling sometimes forget that this is not a new business. Recycling has existed since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. You could argue it existed since biblical times when somebody finally decided to beat a plowshare or a sword into a plowshare. You know, I grew up in this industry. My grandfather was in this industry, and it's seen its ups and downs over the years for centuries. And this is nothing new. It's just some of these municipalities aren't accustomed to going through a downturn, so they're panicking. But it's nothing new, and this too shall pass.
That was Adam Minter, author of Junkyard Planet and the blog Shanghai Scrap. So recycling is about economics, and it's also about carbon emissions. And here, John Tierney makes a different argument. In your piece, the point that jumped out at me was to offset the carbon emission from one plane to Europe, you'd have to recycle about 40,000 plastic bottles. Are you saying we should focus less on recycling our kitchen waste and more on the impact of flying?
If you're concerned about carbon emissions, you're much better off. You'll do much more for the planet by worrying about things that really contribute to the greenhouse effect, which would be air travel is probably the number one thing. Having a second home is another huge contributor, and using your car an awful lot. These things actually make a big contribution. Recycling just doesn't make that much difference to the overall carbon footprint of America, and especially recycling of anything besides paper or metal. More than 90% of the benefit of recycling, the greenhouse benefit, comes from paper and cardboard and metal. The other stuff, the glass, the plastics, the yard waste, the food waste, is just minuscule. And you're fooling yourself if you think that doing that absolves you from your other environmental sins, if that's the way you see putting carbon in the atmosphere.
Back to Adam Minter.
Well, that's a very interesting point. In fact, I wrote a column on just that topic on carbon emissions from jet flights a few months ago. And that is a relevant argument. I mean, it's a different argument, but when you're talking about the amount that we actually travel by jet and the amount of emissions, I think it's around 2-3% of global carbon emissions come from aviation. That's a real problem. But if we sort of circle it back to recycling, we're recycling all these bottles. If you recycle 40,000 bottles, that offset doesn't need to go to jet travel. I mean, it could go to travel on the 405. For sure, I mean, I think we do need to be thinking about these jet travel and what contribution it makes to the global emissions debate. But in terms of recycling, I mean, offsets are offsets, and it just depends on how you want to apply them.
That was Adam Minter, author of Junkyard Planet and the blog Shanghai Scrap. And you also heard John Tierney. He's the science writer for the New York Times. Coming up after this break, do you want to live on Mars or simply have a better bus stop in Los Angeles?
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Now, how to make public transit more enjoyable. No one likes waiting for a bus, especially in the hot, dry, and often empty streets of Los Angeles. And there are a lot of streets in LA, 7,500 miles of them. LA Mayor Eric Garcetti has an answer. And DNA's Avishai Artsy went to check it out. Hello, Avishai.
Hi, Frances.
So tell us all about this.
Well, what Garcetti is doing is unveiling these smart bus benches, as they're called. It looks a little bit like a wooden bench with a barbecue grill in the middle of it, and on top of the barbecue grill is a solar panel. And even though there's no real signage explaining what you can do, there are two USB ports where if you have a phone and your charger, you can plug into the bench and use solar power to charge your phone or other device. There's also free Wi-Fi. Although I have to say that when I tried it the other day, the Wi-Fi didn't work, which was a little bit disappointing.
But being a good journalist, you call the mayor's office, and what did they tell you?
Yes, I called the mayor's office, and I talked to someone in the press office there, and they said that they're going to talk to the French outdoor advertising company that administers these bus benches and bus shelters, JC Deco, which, they take care of the benches and shelters in exchange for advertising space. I should add that there's not just the Wi-Fi and the plug-in, but there's also a new LED screen that updates the times for when the next bus is coming. And there's even a button you can push and it will talk to you if, you're reading impaired. It can tell you when the next bus is coming. Here's what that sounds like.
Real-time predictions. 53 north to downtown LA, Beaudry and 5th Street. Arriving in 7 minutes and in 12 minutes. The time is 7:50 a.m.
So you were there quite early on a Monday morning. Did you meet people while you were there? And what was their reaction to this new bench?
Yeah, there are a few people waiting for the bus and there are other people just kind of walking by. And so I grabbed them and asked them what they thought of it. None of them had heard of the bus bench and really knew what it was. Like I said, there's not really a sign explaining what it does, but they seem pretty excited about it. First, you'll hear Brenda Lopez and then another woman named Corinne, who declined to give us her last name, but she lives just around the corner from this bus stop at 43rd and Central Avenue.
Yeah, I'll use it. I think it's cool.
What would you use it for?
If the bus is taking too long and my phone is out of power, then I'll use it to connect it to charge it.
How long do you usually wait for a bus?
Last time I waited for an hour.
I don't even know what that is, actually. I've never heard of it. I saw it right there and I was like, okay, what is this? But nobody ever really told us what it was, so I was like, oh, okay.
Now that you know that you can charge your phone on it and use Wi-Fi, is it something you think you would use?
Yeah, definitely. Especially because when you're taking the bus, you're looking up next bus and everything like that, so you're constantly using your phone. Actually, that's the reason why my battery dies a lot, because I'm always on next bus. So, yeah, I think it's pretty convenient.
And how often do you use the buses?
Every day.
To get to work mostly? Or?
Yeah, work, school, church. I don't have a car. I don't think about getting a car because I just take the bus. It's convenient for me. I come from L.A., Hollywood, Beverly Hills. Like, I go everywhere on the bus. Long Beach, like, pretty much all the buses, the systems and everything. I'm pretty familiar with it.
So, you know, okay, a few little hiccups with the Wi-Fi, but generally this sounds kind of high-tech.
Yeah, I think this is part of Mayor Garcetti's push to embrace technology as a city and then also to change the way that we interact with our streets. In fact, that's part of what he told us when we spoke to him a little bit earlier.
Benches are probably the worst place to sit. I grew up taking the RTD bus every single day. And, you know, I remember what it was like to sit on a hard bench, nothing to do, waiting, no information about when the bus is coming, stepping out in the street to see if a bus is on its way. And so we wanted to have a bus shelter and street furniture that reflected our creativity and had a practical value. Charging your phone, free Wi-Fi, information of when the next bus is coming. Those things seemed to be something that could improve the quality of life. LED lights that could make it safer and brighter while you're waiting at night. And those have a real impact on the life of a street. So great streets aren't just about flashy things. They're about practical and meaningful things that improve the quality of your experience.
Improving amenities around public transit is a really important element of getting people more excited about using public transit. And a really important piece of that is what is called in planning circles the first mile, last mile concept. This notion that part of the transit experience is the getting to the transit. So that which can involve in LA walking for 2 miles in scorching sun or coming home late at night and finding yourself alone on a very long street. One of the criticisms that's already floating around about these bus stops is lack of shade. Was that a fair criticism and did you look into that piece?
Yeah, I think that is a valid criticism. The people that I spoke to outside this smart bus bench and shelter did say that, yeah, they don't enjoy standing under the hot sun waiting for a bus. I mean, next to the bus bench, which is uncovered, there is the bus shelter, which does have an overhang, so you could wait there, and there's a bench underneath it, so there is some shade there. With the bus bench, there's no shade because it relies on the sun for the solar power that charges the plug-ins for your phone. Now, another complaint that I did hear is the fact that Metro has been cutting back on bus service in place of trains and light rail. And so one woman that I talked to about that is Barbara Lott Holland, the co-chair of the Bus Riders Union.
That's like putting a Band-Aid over a wound that needs stitches. I mean, we should be concentrating on having more buses, 24-hour service, and zero-emission buses at that. If the buses ran more efficiently, more frequently, there would be hardly any need to have a Wi-Fi service because you wouldn't be at the bus stop long enough to be even using it.
So Avishai, you mentioned the French company Deco that is running this and that's using this as a form of advertising. We should note that this is a public-private partnership. The Great Streets Initiative does not have a big budget. And in fact, each of these benches, I believe, cost around $3,800. Is that correct?
Yeah, $3,800, which is about $2,000 more than the traditional non-smart bus bench would cost.
But it's substantially less than was paid in the city of Santa Monica, which spent $7 million on a replacement for all its bus shelters. Now, in Santa Monica, they went for a very strong look. They brought in designer Lorcan O'Herlihy, and they developed the big blue bus shelters that really sort of brand the city. Some love them, some less so. In the city of LA, they've taken a whole different approach. And I wonder, Avishai, did this feel like you were standing by an advertisement? Or did it feel like it was kind of beautifying the street?
I wouldn't say that it beautified the street. I also wouldn't say that it was an advertisement. It kind of just stood out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, there was really nothing around this bus bench. It's next to a strip mall with a Dollar Tree and a check cashing place. But, you know, it doesn't really stand out. And so we asked Mayor Garcetti how he feels this compares to the very highly branded Santa Monica bus benches.
You know, the nice thing about Metro or the LA MTA, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, is that we are countywide. And I think folks like their neighborhood identity and their city identity But I would like to see iconic LA architecture that really transcends not just the city of LA, but all over. So we are having that conversation at Metro. Phil Washington, our new CEO, I said, we really have to do great design, whether it's, for instance, the new Broad Museum, which just opened, behind it is going to be a connector to the downtown connector. So there will be a bridge that comes up from the stop that is right behind the Broad Museum. And I don't want that just to be any old bridge. It should be an architecturally significant bridge, which doesn't mean it has to cost a cent more. It just means it has to be thoughtful. I think LA will never have one unified, iconic look. We've done that before, but you know, out in San Gabriel Valley and Pasadena, for instance, the Gold Line stops evoke you know, the craftsman architecture. At LACC, it's more modernist on the Vermont corridor. So I think I want some cues that do connect, but also some of the boldness of the individual communities that we have. But we shouldn't settle for bad design or even mediocre bus benches.
That was Mayor Eric Garcetti. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Well, I doubt there'll be bus stops on Mars, but some believe there will be homes on the Red Planet within the next few decades. What might those living spaces look like? I guess a lot of us have been thinking about that since the opening of the movie The Martian, which has been the blockbuster for the last couple of weekends. In case you haven't seen it yet, Matt Damon plays Mark Watney, an astronaut stranded on Mars who has to figure out how to survive until he's rescued.
I gotta figure out a way to grow 3 years worth of food here on a planet where nothing grows. Luckily, I'm a botanist.
Seems far-fetched, but people like Elon Musk, the founder of PayPal, Tesla, and SpaceX, well, he says people will be setting foot on Mars within our lifetimes. Here he is speaking to CNN's Fareed Zakaria earlier this year.
Well, I think we could probably send the first person in about 12 years.
Wow. Will you be that person?
Only if I'm confident that SpaceX will be fine if I die.
Another Mars fanatic is Kerry Joles. He's president of the Total Learning Research Institute in Oklahoma. And back in 1985, he wrote the Mars One Crew Manual. We should add that he got his start in space as a child actor back in 1958 on this animated TV show.
The Space Explorers.
Kerry Joles played the voice of Jimmy Perry, who stowed away in a shipping crate on a rocket ship.
Their destination, Mars.
That's what got him interested in space in the first place, and now he spends his time imagining how to get other people excited about living on Mars. So he's teamed up with engineers and programmers and the architecture firm Kieran Timberlake to create a realistic model of a Martian space colony that he's calling Mars City. In a moment, more about it. But first up, why do he and others want to live on Mars?
That's a good question. Basically, single planet species don't survive. The dinosaurs were wiped out because they didn't have a dinosaur colony on the moon or on Mars when the asteroid hit 65 million years ago. So it is kind of an imperative that at some point, if you know, the Earth will have a collision or the sun will become a red giant or something will happen, and if we have populated the solar system and other planets in the galaxy, then the human species goes on. The other probably less severe scenario is that by nature we are a migrating species. Humans started apparently in East Africa and migrated all over the planet, adapting to some of the most incredibly harsh environments like the Eskimos and people in the rainforest, people in the desert, developed ways to live in these harsh climates. And Mars, by the way, is both. Mars has polar ice caps, so it could be an Arctic environment, and of course it has the vast dry deserts, where although the water discovery, by the way, is very interesting because the water that they discovered was potentially surface water. They've known for a long time, we've got models that show permafrost in the soil under the surface, meaning if you drill down, you'll get rocks with water in them and you can have water, something which they didn't use in the film, interestingly enough. He had to make it using the hydrazine fuel from the launch vehicle.
Tell us about Mars City.
Mars City would be an environment for about 100 people, and it's designed literally to be a complete support system. There are Modular construction, very much like what you see in the movie. You need modules. If one module fails, as the central module did in the movie, some of the sub-modules can be isolated, so not everybody dies immediately. There are common areas. You do need space. You can't, as you saw, go out, just walk outside on Mars. So if you're inside a lot, you want to have some large spaces. That's one of the things that the architects looked at, in how do we get light and windows into these larger spaces to give you a sense of openness, since you just can't walk out on the surface.
That's Kerry Joles. Mars City is an immersive 3D virtual environment that's intended as an educational tool for students, from high school physics classes to architecture undergrad to would-be Mark Watneys. The designers of Mars City considered not just the production of food, but of the basic building materials to keep a city alive. Remember that the nearest Home Depot is millions of miles away, and Mars dwellers will have to make building components using 3D printers. Another key element is sustainable systems such as solar energy and water reclamation. Leah Oxenhandler is one of the designers.
So I think as we think about designing spaces for people on another planet, where humans can feel a sense of place and a sense of home, so just like on Earth, I think habitation on Mars would certainly require us to define, as Kerry was saying, public and private spaces, actually making spaces for people, creating multiple scales of interaction and gathering. And we would also think about how to integrate nature and views into our designs.
Are we going to be growing potatoes in our fertilized by our own poop? Or
Well, I actually think that one of the biggest differences between Mars City and the Hab in The Martian is that you don't see the food production spaces that we've built into Mars City because we're thinking about a long-term mission where people are actually living on Mars. We have spaces for food production that allow for sustainable agriculture. So you don't have to grow the food out of your own poop. You can actually have a hydroponics area of your food production, and there's actually spaces that allow for aquaculture to happen within a very controlled environment of the Hab. And I think it's also important to say that the inhabitants who live in Mars City would have to be very technically oriented, which is the students' job in the Mars City simulation. They're supposed to be constantly making repairs and doing routine maintenance at Mars City within the virtual environment.
So the Hab, or the habitation module in The Martian, is white and clinical. You know, it's functional. Did you have discussions about, okay, you've got 100 people stuck up there on Mars for quite a time. What does it look like, their Mars City? Is it clinical and white? Or did you talk about other kind of architectural visions? Did you talk about having artists come up and do paintings on the walls? You know, what was that a part of your discussion?
It has been thought of fairly clinically. You have a couple of issues. One is you have to control the temperature inside. And so the actual Mars City may have a couple of different functionalities. One is, different colors obviously can warm or cool. On Mars, 50 degrees is a hot summer day, Fahrenheit. Most of the time it's near or below zero, which is why he was so cold. So that's a problem. And you want the color would have to be something that either absorbed or reflected sufficient energy to maintain thermal things. The other thing is, unlike the Earth, where you have the Van Allen radiation belts, solar energy and cosmic rays come right through the thin atmosphere of Mars, so the radiation environment is much more dangerous. And so some of Mars City will have to have coatings that absorb micrometeoroids, that insulate, and some of them may actually be buried in the Earth to protect from radiation. So some may be above surface, some may be below surface.
Now,
Francis, can one
yes.
of us give a more conceptual answer to that?
yes, please. And you
go ahead, Fatima.
So I think in the same way that when you create a home or a building on Earth, you know, it's not just about the performance criteria, right? You have specific performance criteria for any type of building, whether it's on Earth or it's on Mars. But I think one of the other things that we're also looking at is what type of material can be functional but can also, you know, start to create a sense of place and create a sense of home. You know, what are those materials that, yes, are durable and can be repaired? Because, as Carrie mentioned, you don't really have a Home Depot that you can run off and get to. So these are really some of the things that we are thinking about and really hope to answer. You know, what are those elements that make that city kind of a habitable place to be?
That was Fatima Olivieri from architecture firm Kieran Timblake. Before that, you heard Leah Oxenhandler and Kerry Joles, president of the Total Learning Research Institute and author of the Mars One Crew Manual. So what do you think? Would you like to live on Mars? And if so, how would you want your home there? Email us your thoughts to dna@kcrw.org. That's it for today's DNA. The show's producer is Avishai Artsy. The show was mixed by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Find more DNA on our blog at kcrw.com/DNA and follow us on our Facebook page at kcrwdna. I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening.